Thank you, Philip. Well, as usual with Philip, you're left wishing he'd say what he really thought. And I do see a member of the Charity Commission in the audience, and I will use the tea break just to check the fine print on members of staff making party political points. But I think given that Philip's equally tough on pretty much everybody, we're probably okay on that front. I did also slightly wonder, listening to Philip, having listened to Dave as well, when Philip said that Cameron's conservatism, again, to discuss yours if you weren't here, David, is more radical and far-reaching than many people think. I started to wonder whether or not it's more radical and far-reaching than even you think. and that rather than you running a plot, you're actually the victim of a plot that we're perpetrating here at Demos as well. Anyway... there's lots in there, obviously, the civic state, market state, and David's comments about opportunity and mobility now being conservative themes as well. But I want to open up the floor now to you. I will call on you. Do you mind speaking to me, do it in groups of three in the sort of traditional way? I can just about remember. I can count to three, and that way we'll get through more questions. If you wouldn't mind indicating who you are, and of course there'll be... ladies and gentlemen of the Fourth Estate, whose hands went straight up. So, yes, Martin there, the gentleman next to you, and I think it's Jean at the back. So far left over there and there. Actually, Jean, why don't you go first while we're waiting? Is that Jean?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Jean Eaglesham, FT. David, you talked about no return to the old economy and building a new economy, but what does that actually mean in practice, other than encouraging a bit of green technology, which Labour wants to do as well? I mean, are you going to radically... reduce the contribution of the city? Are you going to encourage other sectors? What does that actually mean?
Okay, great, thank you. Martin?
Yes, Martin Bright from the New Statesman. Couldn't sit by and hear the magazine's name used in vain in that way. So here
I didn't
we
use
go.
It in vain. I was
plugging it.
That bloke. Yeah.
It needs it.
I should emphasise I'm not from the Smith Institute, actually. I'm from the New Statesman.
Look what I did to Colin Toynbee. You better be careful.
No, it follows on a little bit from the previous question, which is I'd like to know what exactly is progressive about the Conservative Party's hands-off approach to the economic downturn. And if the government's interventionist approach is now being shown to fail, why not simply stick with the traditional Tory instincts and let the recession rip?
Okay, very good. And the gentleman just to your right.
Hi, it's Martin Coder from Islington Conservatives. You don't get much more progressive than Islington.
I'm not sure that's David's or Philip's view.
I just wanted to... You ran through various policy areas where you could display that you've got progressive policies to pursue at the end. One of the areas you left out was tax. And I just wanted to get you to talk me through how one of the major policies that you announced a couple of years ago that really turned around the electoral landscape, i.e. the raising the inheritance tax thresholds to £1 million... actually indicates that you have the same ends as the left, because to me it shows that you, as Conservatives, I mean, I support that policy, we value freedom as a philosophical value more than we do equality, because it's the freedom to do what you want with your own money, whereas it's not promoting the goal of equality, because it's endowing some children with more assets than other children.
Okay. Great, okay, so we've got something a bit crunchier on economic policy. What's progressive about not having an economic policy? And what about tax?
Dave, okay, first, Jean's question, not going back to the old economy. I mean, well, what we're talking about is an economy that's better balanced between north and south, better balanced between manufacturing, technology and aerospace and things like that, rather than just finance and housing. And also better balanced in terms of making sure that everyone shares in the proceeds of that economy rather than the sort of booster capitalism that we've had from Gordon Brown. What are the things that we're going to do? Well, you mentioned the green economy. I think actually having a proper interactive green energy network rather than the passive grid we have, that is hugely important for enabling a green economy. I think the priority we've given to high-speed rail to actually shrink the country and rebalance between north and south, I think that is important. The what we're saying about proper apprenticeships rather than the sort of ersatz ones we have now, again, that gives a boost to manufacturing and other industries like that. The emphasis on transport actually helps manufacturing as opposed to service industries because they have to move their goods around the country. So it's in all of those ways. I think that the challenge that Philip is throwing out is a really good one for us to think about, though, because it is saying, look, in social policy, you've talked about a stronger civic society and smaller organisations, voluntary bodies, charities, the little platoons, etc. If you believe that about social reform, you should also believe it about economic reform. I think that's part of your challenge to us. Martin's question. There is nothing hands-off about our approach to this recession. In fact, the biggest, boldest policy that's been proposed in the last few months is ours for a national loan guarantee scheme, a £50 billion scheme to get business lending again. The point is we have to be smart rather than dumb. And the smart thing to do is to recognise that at the heart of the recession is a credit crunch. And the Prime Minister's problem is that he spent so much time on other things that have been so irrelevant and useless, like the VAT cut. I mean, you can't find a government minister now who'll come out and defend it. What a waste of £12.5 billion. What a waste of all that government energy and activity when they should have been focusing on the real problem, which is the credit crunch. So there's nothing hands-off. I think, actually, his whole approach of saying, the Tories do nothing, is beginning to backfire because it's like so many of the things he says, it is self-evidently nonsense. And when you go on saying things that are self-evidently nonsense, you eventually trash your own reputation. Let's have a little quiz of the self-evidently nonsense things he said. I didn't look at the polls when I cancelled the election. Probably did him more damage than anything else. I think what is doing huge damage to him at the moment is this statement, this all comes from America. You see, I don't say this recession all comes from Gordon Brown. Of course it doesn't. There are international problems and causes, but he has a responsibility too. So I'm saying something rational, sensible, and logical. He is saying something self-evidently nonsense. It was no wicked American that gave us the biggest budget deficit in the developed world. It wasn't a wicked American who ran Royal Bank of Scotland. It was actually someone called Fred Goodwin, who the Prime Minister gave a knighthood to. This is a nonsense argument. And I think, I hope he goes on making it, because I think it's doing him enormous damage. So nothing hands off about our response to the recession. And also we need to look, and we have been looking, at all the individual markets. How can we help get the unemployed back to work? A £3 billion scheme there. How can we help in the housing market to prevent unnecessary repossessions? On all of the markets, I would argue, the Conservatives have been making some very, very sensible policy prescriptions. The question from my friend from Islington is a very good one. With inheritance tax, I would defend it in two ways. One is to say, look, we do believe in a society which encourages families to pass on to future generations, that believes in wealth cascading down the generations. And the key on the inheritance tax issue was that something had happened in Britain where suddenly families who didn't see themselves at all as wealthy, who'd bought a house for £100,000, £150,000, £200,000 many, many years ago, it was their family home, suddenly found that they were going to be in this net of inheritance tax. And it completely changed their whole perspective about the sort of family they were and their ambitions to hand their home on to their children rather than the tax man. And that's why there was such a head of steam about inheritance tax, and that's why I think it was entirely right to make that change and to say, look, this is not a tax that should be paid by people who aren't wealthy. And that's why £1 million, I think, is very wealthy. £1 million is the right place to be. In terms of tax policy, again, I would argue there are conservative means of a simplified tax system, flat rates, fewer exemptions, or a simplified tax system can be a conservative means to achieve the progressive end of actually higher economic growth and better spread economic growth than we have today. So I think even in tax policy, we can make this progressive conservatism work. Okay. Sorry, I hate taking questions in three because it gives politicians an opportunity to ramble on. Terrible
right,
thing.
Okay, so how many? We'll cut it back and down for next time. But when you accused Gordon Brown of spouting self-evident nonsense, just for the record to be clear, you weren't making any party political points.
No, of course.
Points,
so. I just it was something I meant to get off my chest.
Exactly, it's a personal point. No,
time doesn't always
exactly.
Allow.
Can I just let Philip in? And I specifically want to ask Philip on the inheritance tax point, because a large part of your speech is about recapitalising the poor and the massive wealth gap that you pointed to. If that's true, then surely the moves on inheritance tax by both parties has been in the wrong direction thus far, and you'd expect it to go the other way.
Inheritance tax wouldn't be a problem if we didn't have so many people who have essentially nothing. And therefore, what I think we should do is move away from models of income welfare to models of asset welfare. And what I'd actually do is I would link the taxation of inheritance tax to building up assets, investment packages for the poor. Then it's just a question of where you set the level for inheritance tax. I probably would have set it somewhat lower, but I think that it's important that people have something to pass on. And I think the real key is to talk about the 50% of people who have not, of the entire population, who have virtually nothing. They've been, savings rates are down to levels last seen in the 1940s. Brown's debt burden has fallen on the low-waged poor, who, in essence, whose wages aren't high enough and so can't make ends meet and so take on credit. We have to recapitalise the poor and then protect them from taxation. And this takes me to another point about tax. Why the left is so fond of tax is, for me, quite peculiar, because invariably the poor always pay the highest amount of tax per capita of their income. Taxation is not a panacea. The task of tax is to widen the tax base, include as many in it as possible, so it can be as low as possible. So I think the agenda for the agenda I think the Conservatives should follow is that of eliminating tax havens, is that of moving to including more people in the tax base so that more people pay tax so it can be lesser for everybody. The point of fact the left really has to take on board is as soon as you introduce tax, the very poorest pay the highest percentage of their income in taxation. Yeah. As to onto the Conservative economic policy, I'm actually going to defend your policy, David. I think that whether or not it's realised, the economic policy pursued by both David Cameron and George Osborne is far more Keynesian than anything Gordon Brown is doing. It's very clear that Keynes said the following. The crucial point before you engage in fiscal simulation is controlling the real rate of interest. So therefore, right from the get-go, Osborne's emphasis on ensuring that we have business and the private sector paying the lowest possible rates of interest was absolutely the right one. And indeed, the National Loans Guarantee Scheme, which is a credit expansion scheme, can't be understood as monetarist. It's about delivering real rates of low interest to the private sector. What Brown is doing is essentially bankrupting the public sector from the basis of a bankrupt private sector. Instead, what he should be doing, and what I think, is universalising and in some way delivering the lowest possible rates of interest for the private sector. At the moment, for non-investment grade companies, which roughly speaking is about 50% of all British companies, they're paying around 25% on their corporate debt. 25%. Even investment grade companies are paying on their debt in the double figures. It varies according to which company. You can only have recovery if you grow the private sector. The public sector won't give you recovery. You need the private sector to grow. And if the private sector are paying those rates of interest, we are heading for an almighty financial meltdown. Then what I would actually suggest the Conservatives do is follow through the logic of their interest rate policies, eminently the correct one. The expansion of the debt of the public sector is doing no good. What I think they need to do, and this would be, is follow through the logic, embrace quantitative easing. The government needs to buy gilt, so to free the money markets to buy corporate debt. That's the only way you can drive down the real rate of interest, long term and short term, for the private sector, and so stimulate a private sector recovery. Gordon Brown's weird, screwed up insurance policy. He's buying an asset he doesn't know the value of. How can you insure on an asset you don't know the value of? If the government pays too much, he bankrupts the public sector. If he pays too little, the banks themselves collapse yet again and will need a third bailout.
Okay. Sorry. Thank you. Right, some more hands. Very good. I was not worried about you going on, dude. Right. Yes, right at the front here, and then the two gentlemen there. So, yes, Bob.
My name is Bob Gavron, and I'm an entrepreneur. Of course, I applaud David Cameron's four objectives for progressive conservatism. Who in this room wouldn't? But I want to ask him what his opinion is of the present credit crunch, and whether he agrees that it is the failure of the financial services sector who have shown us arrogance, excessive greed, and total incompetence. And would he do something, if he were in government, to reduce the croupier's take, which the financial services sector now creams off everybody's pension, everybody's money? Would he do anything to curb the excessive greed causes the people who are running the financial services sector to pay themselves multi-million pound salaries and bonuses while they are bankrupting the country.
Thank you. I am going to do three and rely on you to keep your answers short. Sure. I'm going to devolve responsibility to you for keeping your answers short. Nick there, and then the gentleman next to you.
Nick Watt from The Guardian. It's a question for David. David, in your speech, you talked about the danger in this financial crisis of the money running out and that that could mean to cuts in public services. And Philip, in his speech, talked about how this could be the biggest moment since 1979. How Groundhog Day is it going to be from the 1970s? And are we going to do the full hog and end up having to go to the IMF?
Okay, actually, I'm just going to go here. I'm going to do four, just to complete your three. The lady there, and then the gentleman there.
Okay, I'm Janice Small. I'm on Davy's list of candidates and desperately seeking to fight a seat at the next general election.
No job adverts.
Absolutely
no applications for jobs.
I do believe that education is key to progressive conservatism. I was in a school yesterday. I go in as a woman in business, and I talk to girls about career choices. And I'm struck by their lack of aspiration. There's no social mobility in some of the key target seats that we've got to fight at the next general election. But David, one of the hardest policies I think that we're going to have to sell to parents is you don't have to have a state education. We've got a new progressive policy, and I think that's going to be one of the hardest ones to explain. Can you two explain to the left in this room, in simple terms, how it's actually going to work and we're going to increase social mobility?
Thanks. If the left in the room could also identify themselves so we know who you are, that would be helpful. And then, yes, the gentleman next to Nick Watt. Yes.
Hi, I'm Max Wincowie, and I'm from Mind, the mental health charity. Following on, actually, from what you were saying about education being such a progressive policy under the Conservatives and what Michael Gove's done is very root and branch in terms of his suggestions, I wondered whether you could expand a little on what progressive conservatives believe about the healthcare system and about the NHS, because that hasn't been quite so dramatic and quite so radical in terms of what's been said thus far.
Okay, so do you think greed's a good thing? And if not, what are you going to do about it? Financial services regulation. Did you get Nick's? What was Nick's question?
Yeah, are we going to run out of money, IMF and all that?
Can I have a seat / more about our education policy?
Yeah.
And what about health, which are very quiet?
Yes, good. Okay, thank you for those. Well, Bob, first of all, I mean, in terms of, you know, what has happened, what has gone wrong, I mean, there's been too much debt. It's the simple way to think of it. Too much debt in the private sector, too much company debt, and too much government debt as well. And we have to deal with all of those things. In terms of, you know, what would a Conservative government do and what would it do differently, I think, again, there are sort of three quite important answers. The first is that the regulatory system has failed. And we state that very clearly. I think the head of the FSA was sort of saying that on the radio this morning, but the government can't seem to own up to it, and it needs to. You know, the system failed to call time on debt. I think one of the weaknesses of it, and it's probably something Philip would agree with, is regulation is about having the right rules, but also having the right institutions. Conservatives understand that institutions matter, and I think that decision to take the Bank of England out of the regulatory picture in terms of regulating the level of debt in the economy was a big mistake, and I'd put it back in the picture. It needs to be the debt referee, as it were. I also think there are problems with the remuneration packages and so on and so forth in the individual financial organisations. On some occasions, as you were hinting, they were actually incentivised to do things that might have been good for themselves but were terrible for the economy. For instance, if you incentivise people in banks on the return on equity rather than all assets, it encourages them to over-leverage. So simple things like that need to be regulated properly, and they would be, and we've identified them. Nick, money running out, IMF, all of that. Look, I'm not saying that there is some date by which the government will completely run out of money and we will end up back at the IMF. What I'm saying is that we are running the risk of those things happening, and those are risks that no government should responsibly run. That is why I've argued that while I am all in favour of aggressive monetary activism, things like a national loan guarantee scheme, as Philip pointed out, I think on the fiscal side, you know, I think we can't afford the sort of fiscal stimulus that the government went for. I think they not only went for the wrong fiscal stimulus in VAT cut that didn't work and is a joke across the high street, I think they themselves admitted they couldn't really afford it. How so? Well, first of all, it was tiny compared with what is being contemplated in America and elsewhere. And also, even their small fiscal stimulus, they had to accompany with the announcement of a future tax rise. They had to tell people on £19,000, you're going to pay more tax because we've run out of money and this is a bogus stimulus. So I think they made my own argument for me, which is that in this country, because the failure to put aside money in the good years, we couldn't really afford a fiscal stimulus. How bad is the situation? Well, the figures are pretty clear. We're borrowing, according to the government's current estimates, we're going to be borrowing 8% of our GDP in the next financial year. That is the same percentage that Dennis Healey was borrowing when he went to the IMF in 1976. And the frightening and worrying thing is that forecast was made at the same time as the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Prime Minister standing up in the House of Commons and telling us that the economy was going to start growing at the end of June this year. Now, I profoundly hope that does happen, but a lot of people think it probably won't, in which case, in the March budget, there will be some pretty shocking debt figures and things will get worse. So that is my position on those things. Janice, very best of luck in getting a seat. There are still plenty more to select, and if this Parliament runs for longer, there may be one or two colleagues who decide not to stand all over again. So good luck. We are arguing in favour of... Sorry?
Any names?
No. I leave that to the Chief Whip. We are arguing in favour of state education. What we're talking about is to bust open the state monopoly, to allow new schools to come in, to set up, whether they're academies, whether they're run by charities, voluntary bodies, or even private schools, coming in and setting up. But they would be free schools. You know, they would be paid according to the pupils they attracted, and no one walking through their doors would have to pay a penny. That is the whole point. We're just opening the market and saying, in terms of state education, why should so much innovation, change, and competition be available in the private sector? Why isn't that available in the state sector? Now, I applaud the academy programme. It's a great programme. It's a brilliant thing. But it's actually, it's getting furred up by Ed Balls and Brown, and it needs to be freed up again, and that's what we would do. One of the things in terms of encouraging aspiration and mobility is, I think, mentoring is vitally important, what you're doing, and I'd like to see much more aggressive promotion of the voluntary sector in terms of mentoring and what we can do as a government to encourage it, because I think it is absolutely vital. Max, on healthcare, yes, you're correct in noticing that while we have a huge belief in the progressive ends we want to achieve in terms of narrowing health inequalities, which have become appalling in our country. There are parts of Glasgow where life expectancy is lower than on the Gaza Strip. While we want to achieve that progressive aim, I don't actually think that some sort of incredibly aggressive sort of break up the health service policy would achieve that aim. I believe in a national health service. I think that it is right that we don't have some insurance-based system. I think there are things we can do to make our health system work better. I think if we make sure that public health is separated and separately funded and guaranteed, that would help hugely. I think if we put the GPs in charge of local health budgets and make them the gatekeepers of the NHS rather than all this bureaucracy that we have at the moment. I think if we free hospitals and make them freestanding institutions that are proud about their own identity and their independence and they can make more choices, the opposite approach, if you like, from the big top-down NHS computer model that we have now. That is, again, I would argue, conservative means of freeing up the health service to achieve that progressive end. But it involves maintaining a national health service free at the point of use. Okay. Was that shorter?
Per question, slightly. Yes, it was. Philip, can I ask you to just hold fire for a minute? Because there are lots of hands up, and ask you to be even shorter when you can. In fact, there's a million hands up. We'll probably do two more rounds. The woman there in the pink... the gentleman here, Jesse, and the gentleman right at the back, there, right at the back, far back corner, yes. There.
Yeah, Emily, yes. Robinson from the Local Government Association. I was interested in the comments on decentralisation, and could you explain a little bit more about what progressive conservatism means for local government and local democracy?
Yeah. Very good. Yes, gentleman there at the back.
Daniel Johnson, Standpoint magazine. David, do you actually agree with what Philip was saying about privileging community over the individual? And if you do, what is the point of having a Conservative Party?
Well, you might want a Liberal Party instead, of course. Jesse.
Hi, Jesse Norman, author of Compassionate Economics. A question for Philip. Could you talk a little bit for a second about civic society? Because there's a worry that society is kind of opposed to civility, and we shouldn't be allowing it to take over our civil life as well as everything else. So if you've got a way of fleshing that out, that would be helpful.
Very good. OK. So local government, what does it mean in practice? The rhetoric of decentralisation and localisation is not new or monopolised by you. Are you just in danger of replacing communitarianism for liberalism? And then Philip Moore on the social stuff. David, you take the first
on, two. On decentralisation, I mean, I think the Conservative Party has made a big change over the last decade of really going back to what it ought to be, which is a party that profoundly believes in decentralisation and local government and local institutions and devolving even beyond that. I think the reason why in the 1980s the Conservatives were seen as against local government was, I think, that it was the reaction of a central government to very sort of loony left authorities that in Liverpool were driving business out of the city, that in Lambeth were doing... You know, there was that sense that you just couldn't let this happen to communities, and so Margaret Thatcher went down that track. I think that we've learned from that experience, and actually now, as I say, are going back to what we really believe, which is in very strong local government, in devolving power and responsibility. I don't think we'll replace sort of local, central, over-big central government with over-big local government, because we ask in each case, can we devolve this power to the individual? If you can't do that, can you devolve it to the community? And if you can't do that, then how do you devolve it to local government? You know, where public services can be individually consumed, then you should, in the case of education, we want to break open the local government monopoly, put the power in the hands of parents to set up new schools, to send their children to new schools and all the rest of it. Where you've got something like the police, which we think is too centralised, too much looking up to Whitehall, we would like to make it more locally accountable. So I think we've got a good theory of how to devolve. And if you look at the policies we are committed to in terms of more city mayors, allowing cities to raise bond finance for infrastructure projects, scrapping the standards board, getting rid of regional government, changing the way all of those regional quangos work and devolving the power down to the lowest level. I mean, it's a really big programme of decentralisation. And you say it's shared by other parties. I don't think it's shared by the government at all. They haven't done any of these things. In fact, if anything, I'd say Gordon Brown is re-regionalising local government by boosting the RDA. So I think we've got a really exciting set of policies there that absolutely fit in with a vision of progressive conservatism. Daniel, I completely disagree with you that, you know, somehow... I mean, conservatism, to me, is not simply about the freedom of the individual. The most important word about in conservatism to me, as I said in my conference speech, is responsibility. And conservatives do believe in institutions and in groups, you know, that society, we have a bottom-up view of society, which is based about our obligations to other people, the organisations that we relate to. And that's hugely important. And I think that, as I was saying about Philip's work, is I think what's so interesting about what he's saying, right, you've recognised this in the social sphere, you're empowering the voluntary sector, you're establishing new institutions in education, you want to bring the private and voluntary sectors into welfare. This is all great stuff in social reform, is your argument, but why don't you recognise that in the economy you also should put a greater value on small business, not having clone high streets, making sure the supermarkets don't ride roughshod over farm, a lot of which I agree with. I mean, I think actually we do hold those views. So I just don't really take the premise of your question. A good conservative to me is one who is a liberal conservative, as I put it, who believes in freedom and choice and empowerment, but recognises that the conservative view of the good society is a responsible society in which we recognise our obligations to other people. Jesse's question was for you.
Mm. You had this lovely line, you quoted someone saying a conservative libertarian who has children.
Yeah, well, it's not mine. Someone else thought of that. there's a lot of... Yeah.
I mean, in order to answer Jesse's question, I'll begin with the question from standpoint. I think the idea that the individual is first is a libertarian position and not truly conservative. I think a true conservative believes that community and individuality occur together, that they're sort of equiprimordial, that one emerges from the other. Because we're not kind of wanton creatures born alone, possessed only of our own will, pursuing whatever desire we have regardless. That's not conservatism. Conservatism is the belief that I'm born into community whose traditions I uphold and I want to repeat, and I want to repeat the communal traditions. The reason why I think there's been such a enormous renaissance under David's leadership, is the broken society spoke very really to people's experience when they walk down British high streets that are all age segregated, where you get sort of single sex groups of sort of vaguely disturbing youngsters moving to highly disturbing youngsters as the night progresses. There's something deeply wrong with our society, where old people are kind of are abandoned, where families shelter behind home watching bad television. There's something truly wrong. And I think that what sort of Ian Duncan Smith's report and what David has fostered, that's why they're popular. That's why they're 20 points ahead, because people agree with it. Most people...
Do you know something I don't?
Exactly. Yes, I was going to tell you later. Yeah,
we're doing our own private polling. But that's why we invited you.
And then to answer Jesse's question, and as I said, I'm a Burkean in the sense that I think that individual and society occurs together. Some societies are better than others. The society in Germany in the 1930s was not a good European society. So therefore, as conservatives, we believe two things. We believe that there's something called the good and the true exists and we can know it. And we believe that human beings can sort between the different traditions. And we're reasonable and we make judgments. So precisely, we're in a damaged, declining, failing culture. We believe that we can see even on our own history, even how we behaved in the 50s or the 30s, or how we behaved during the Second World War. These are symbols of a better way of relating to each other. Part of conservatism is to recover what was good about the past and to refashion it for the future. And part of the role of the conservative state isn't to dictate that, but to facilitate it, to create the conditions whereby people can form their own associative cultures and we can actually have a rebirth of what we once were. The last time Britain's localities were great was in the 19th century when cities could issue their own bonds, and David's proposing exactly that again. This surely should be welcomed by anybody who isn't entirely contaminated by ideology. This is good. This is morally, politically, and economically good. And then to add to what David's saying about the public sector, look, I worked in a university. My frontline colleagues were superb. My students were superb. But the managers were awful. The managerialism, the targets, the endless faculty academic standards coordination meetings that absorbed count. God, each meeting must have cost 200 grand. Pointless. The conservative agenda to reprofessionalise the public services is a wonderful thing. And it will give nurses, doctors, university lecturers, whomever, once more, they should run their institutions. It's no accident that the best universities in the country are run by academics, Oxford and Cambridge. Let's repeat that model further down the scale so this awful, appalling, central managerial agenda doesn't bleed the public sector white, deprofessionalise us, destroy productivity, eliminate ethos, and make us jobs worths. Let's restore the culture and the ethos of an empowered civic society that believes in what it does, just like the army, in spite of how it's dealt with, does, just like the police do, and just like all of us who used to work in the public service, and many do still do. We've got to set them free to reprofessionalise, and this, again, is part of David's civic agenda, and it can apply to the public sector.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. Now, I'm going to risk the wrath of David's advisor by just having a very, very quick fire last round. By the way, your discussion of how academics work, I mean, you haven't seen yet how Demos works. Perhaps we could restrict the last round to people who are, in fact, entirely contaminated by ideology. Only keep your hands up if you feel you fall into that contaminated category. I see Jenny Russell's hand up there. So, Jenny, the gentleman right at the very back holding the piece of paper and the lady right here at the front. If you could keep your questions to 30 seconds and David and Philip keep their answers to a minute and a half, then David will escape without me getting lynched by his aides. Okay, let's start with... Who did I get? Yes, Jenny.
Hello, David. I'm from The Guardian. I know what you think about the fiscal stimulus, and I know that what you think about the loan guarantee scheme, but what would you have done about the banks? If you were sitting there, would you be letting them go under and let the market take its course, which was what Soros' partner was advocating yesterday? Or would you actually be intervening on the same scale?
Good, thank you. The gentleman right at the back, And then if we could bring the mic down here to the lady at the front, that would be great. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Ahmed Shahzad. I'm a participant of the Uprising Leadership.
Sorry, what's your name?
Ahmed Shahzad.
Yeah.
I'm a participant of the Uprising Leadership Program run by Young Foundation, and Mr. Cameron is our patron. And my question is, in terms of decision making, is young people or are young people involved in forming progressive conservatism? If they are, then how?
Okay, great. And hello here.
Patricia Rawlings, Demos produces interesting foreign affairs pamphlets. I'd like to ask David, what are progressive conservative priorities in foreign affairs?
You might need a bit more than 30 seconds for that one, David. I'm afraid, Janice, I'm afraid it's from the response Philip got last time. I think if there was a seat going begging, it might actually go to Philip Blonde, actually, given the response to last time. Of course, you wouldn't start from here, David, but that doesn't help us know what you would have done.
Absolutely.
What about young
we
people?
You cannot allow the banking system to collapse. That was why I sort of interrupted my own party conference to say, you know, that I thought that, I mean, before the party conference started, I said I thought some form of recapitalisation was necessary, and if it happened, we would support it. And I thought it was important to say that because of what had happened in America. We had this appalling dogfight over the first attempt at recapitalisation. And so that's why, you know, we have to do what it takes to stop the collapse of major financial institutions, because the lessons of the 1930s are very clear, that if you allow the collapse of major financial institutions, you don't get a recession, you get a slump. My argument with the government has been on a number of levels. One is that I think that they were insufficiently focused on the need to get credit out of the banks and into businesses. And we were arguing, you know, for a couple of months about the National Loan Guarantee Scheme before they fully picked up the importance of what we were saying. The second thing is, what they did was they did the recapitalisation the first round and then kind of backed off and thought, right, we've done it. But actually, it became very obvious, and I raised it at Prime Minister's Questions before Christmas, that the details were wrong, that because they were lending the money to the banks at 14%, but expecting the banks to lend it out at 6%, it just wasn't happening. And they needed to revisit the recapitalisation, which is what they've now done, and they've accepted many of the things that we've said. I think the real problem we've got now is this insurance scheme, as Philip said, they've given us no detail. They can't tell us what they're insuring, how long the insurance is going to last, what the premium is, or what the potential downside, what the taxpayer is effectively in for. And an opposition, I think, you know, constitutionally, should be asking some pretty tough questions about that before saying, yes, this is absolutely fine, we agree to every part of it. And that is exactly what I'm doing. Sadly, yesterday I didn't get any answers. But no, you cannot let the banking system collapse. It would result in a slump. The question about foreign affairs, I do need longer than a minute and a half. But what I've set out is this, what I call a liberal conservative foreign policy. It's a blending, if you like, of this belief that we are liberal and progressive. We want to see the spread of democracy and human rights and freedom around the world. That's the liberal part. The conservative part is that we are cautious, prudent, sensible, sceptical people. We are a little bit sceptical of grand schemes to remake the world. And, for instance, when we look at Afghanistan, we think, you know, are we going to achieve Switzerland and the Hindu Kush? No. You know, what should we do to try and maximise the chance of a successful outcome? And that is to focus on security and safety and try to get the functioning parts of a state going. And so, you know, my problem with Blair on foreign policy was he was a sort of liberal interventionist without a handbrake, in fact, without any sort of brake. And you need that sceptical conservatism to go with the liberal internationalism. Ahmed asks how young people are involved. Well, I can tell you happily that Conservative Future is now the biggest student organisation on any campus. I was up in Durham the other day and they told me they had, I think it was 200 members of Conservative Future. And I said, why? What has changed? And they said, well, it's down to one person with two words in his name. And I rubbed my hands and thought, this sounds very exciting. I'm going to get bigged up here. And they said, yes, it's Boris Johnson. I think I've been very focused. I've been very focused on trying to open the Conservative Party up to new voices and sources of information and debate and discussion. We've done less well, frankly, on the kind of just getting more members in. I thought the sort of opening up process, the getting more women candidates, the being making huge progress, which we've made with ethnic minority candidates and members and councillors, I think that's more important than just the membership drive. But I guess maybe you need to do both.
I remember a young conservative saying to me that the thing about being a young conservative is not quite the same thing as being young. which I'm sure was terribly unfair and not true anymore. Now, Philip, you have 30 seconds, which on current form means you have the chance to make 0.2% of a point. I think that's probably right. So,
as to the banks, I don't think anyone's in any doubt they needed saving, but I think that we need a parallel banking system through which credit can be delivered to businesses. There's no point buying into a broken system with permanently declining, devaluing assets. We'll need perpetual money, build up public debt, crowd out cheap interest rates as government sucks up all the money. Second point, conservative and foreign policy. I'm a patriot. I believe in British culture and tradition. Therefore, I think we should influence as many people as possible. So I think we should engage with foreigners and enjoy it. As to young people, as to young people, I think they should form their own societies and form their own groups, start to foster concern and care for one another, and install the moral values that will prevent people from falling into just decay. One good thing would be start respecting women. That would be a start for young people in Britain today.
Good. Thank you, Philip. This one will run and run, but I have to cut it off now. It will start running again at exactly 3:45 with John Cruddas, Oliver Letwin, Will Hutton, John Gray, as well as Philip Blond. So have a cup of tea. Please come back at 3:45. In the meantime, join me in thanking not only Philip Blond, but especially David Cameron for joining us today.